Hello and welcome to Sight into Sound Radio's 2017 Christmas special, Mistletoe Mysteries. This year's special is taken from a book titled Tales of Yuletide Murder, Mistletoe Mysteries, a cosy collection of criminality at Christmas time by Charlotte MacLeod. For well over 100 years, the Christmas season has had an irresistible appeal to authors who work in crime. Every one of the great detectives of literature, from Sherlock Holmes to Hercule Poirot to Nero Wolfe, has endured a holiday marred by murder. In this year's special, we will hear stories from two well-known mystery writers that will add some suspense to your holiday season. I'm Pearl Hewitt. Our first story is by Isaac Asimov. Needless to say, Isaac Asimov was a prolific writer and wrote or edited more than 500 books and an estimated 90,000 letters and postcards. His books have been published in 9 of the 10 major categories of the Dewey Decimal classification. In addition to his interest in science, Asimov was also greatly interested in history and also became a noted mystery author and a frequent contributor to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine. He began by writing science fiction mysteries such as his Wendell Earth stories, but soon moved on to writing pure mysteries. We'll begin our special with a story about a sneaky department store Santa titled Ho Ho Ho. Your reader is Jim Abate.
Let's get ready for Christmas Day. Merry Christmas! Baranoff entered the somnolent precincts of the Union Club Library with a most offensive air of cheer and jubilation, to which Jennings and I responded in perfect uniform, "Bah, humbug!" while Griswold snored very softly in his huge winged armchair. "No, really," said Baranoff. "There's even a chance of snow predicted for Christmas Day. We may have a white Christmas." "Goody," I said sourly. "All the little kiddies can take their new sleds and go belly-whopping in New York traffic." "I wonder," said Jennings, "if any New Yorker gives his children a sled for Christmas." "What?" said I, "and expect them to go out in the cold when they can stay home and watch a nice warm television set?" Baranoff said, "You two disgust me. I've half a mind to ask Griswold for a Christmas story. He's bound to have something heartwarming." I don't think Baranoff was serious there, but Griswold began the process of rumbling to life. His eyelids opened, and the ice blue of his eyes penetrated us one after the other. He took a prolonged sip at the scotch and soda he was holding in his hand and said, "Actually, I do have a Christmas story about a friend of mine who had a particularly unpleasant Christmas season." "Oh, well," said Baranoff, "if this is going to be something dreary, no thanks. We'll talk about something else." "Since you insist," said Griswold, "I will tell you the story of a friend of mine whose name was Dan Arbutus, and who worked for me in intelligence in the days before I was fired for the crime of being intelligent. We stayed friends, of course, when he was sure no one was looking, and then eventually he retired on a good pension, which was more than I did, and amused himself by taking on little jobs just to keep himself busy. He came to see me immediately after Christmas about 10 or 12 years ago, shaking his head with a look of deep trouble on his face. 'That's it, Griswold,' he said. 'I'll never be able to look into the face of a Santa Claus again.' Would you believe it, Griswold? Someone walked off with an expensive necklace from the jewelry department right under my nose, and I think they're suspecting me." "What jewelry department is this?" Well, I've been doing little jobs, just keeping my hand in. So I've been serving as a private detective at the Goodwill department store on the east side. They're victimized by shoplifters, you know, especially over the Christmas season. And someone shoplifted a necklace? Yes, but after hours. And this has something to do with Santa Claus? You said you'll never be able to look into the face of a Santa Claus again? Well, yes. Look, Griswold, let me tell you the whole story. I'm not expecting you to supply me with an answer. There are no answers. Believe me, I just want to get it off my chest, and then maybe I can forget it. He hesitated. But first, can I have one more slug? I pushed the bottle in his direction and waited. Finally, he said, "The job's routine, but I like to watch the crowds and keep my eyes open for the wise guys who manage to slip things into their pockets or bags. I give the high sign to the store personnel who are strategically placed, and the lifter is quickly followed till he or she is just outside the street door. Then we whirl them around, bring them back, and search them. You can't stop them before they leave because they always claim they were going to pay and start raising a fuss about their good name and how they're going to sue. But sometimes the department store asks me to take on something outside the regular shoplifter watch. For instance, a couple of weeks ago, they asked me to help out after hours during their training program for Santa Clauses. I stared at them. They trained Santa Clauses? Well, of course. Department stores have Santa Clauses in the Christmas season, and they have to have them in shifts and with replacements, because it's a tiring job. So they need quite a few, and they change around. The kids don't care. With the Santa Claus suit, one person looks like another. Even if the kid comes back and there's another Santa there, he doesn't know. Neither do the parents. Neither do I, for that matter. What is the training about? A lot of things, actually. They can't eat onions or garlic or anything too darn spicy on the job. And they can't drink or smoke either. That's no kidding. If their breath is offensive, they're out on their ears. And they've got to learn how to hold kids. They got to learn how to tell if the child wants to sit on their lap. If the kid is bashful, the kid just stands there. If you can get the parent to put them on your lap, that's better than doing it yourself. Then, too, you got to ask the right things, and you don't make any suggestions yourself. You don't push any products, because that gets parents mad. You've got to repeat everything the kid says, and you got to be cheerful, and you've got to ho, ho, ho a lot. Ho, 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 I said. Dan said, oh, yes, that's essential. Santa Claus is very jolly, even aside from his costume and all the stuffing to make him look fat. His face, what you can see of it, is pink, especially the tip of his nose. And he's got to smile a lot, which means that good teeth are essential. And he has to go, ho, 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 he says. And what's your name, little boy? Joey, that's a very nice name. Ho, ho, ho. And have you been a good boy this year? You have. Wonderful. Ho, ho, ho. And they've got to make that ho, ho, ho good and deep. Believe me, after 2 hours of that, a Santa Claus needs a replacement. I can see that, I said. Dan said, the training is done after hours. It would upset the kids to see a number of Santa Clauses walking about the store. I sometimes wonder how many kids really believe in old SC, but the store has to assume they all do. Anyway, it was only a few days till Christmas, and there were 4 Santa Clauses being trained for last-minute replacements and shifts. They had on their costumes. That's necessary, you know. Those costumes, combined with the padding, are not exactly comfortable, and they don't feel natural. The Santa Clauses have to get used to the feel of it as much as possible, and for that matter, they have to be able to get into them and out of them quickly. Believe me, I learned more about Santa Clauses than they did. I said, look, Dan, since this was after hours and there weren't any customers, why did they need your services? Dan said, they didn't exactly tell me, just asked me to be there and keep my eyes open. After all, the 4 Santa Clauses weren't the only ones in the store at the time. There were various minor executives in charge of the training and personnel, and there were other employees working after hours. It was hinted, without actually being said, that there had been some petty losses that might be inside jobs, so to speak, and I was there to keep an eye out for funny stuff while pretending to watch the Santa Clauses. That particular night, the woman in charge of the jewelry department showed up suddenly, all flustered. She was a tall woman, skinny, with a very high-pitched voice. Everyone called her Mamselle, but she didn't sound French to me. Anyway, she came in and said, "There's something wrong with the warning system in my department." I glared at her, and she stopped short and turned a mottled red. There was nothing wrong with her intelligence, and I supposed she realized that if there was something wrong with her warning system, she shouldn't be announcing it to the whole world. She scuttled away, whimpering, and I thought, well, I'd better take a look at her department after a while. I wandered about, trying to be unnoticeable about it. There was a small coffee break, and the Santa Clauses were standing about, talking in their natural voices. During actual instruction, they practiced their ho-ho-hos a lot and talked bass. I guess it became important to talk just to make sure they had normal voices. Then they were collected and taken on a small tour. They had to know certain places in the store so they could go to their posts and leave them unobtrusively. And for a while, as they gathered, it seemed to me there were 5 Santa Clauses. You mean 5 instead of 4? Yes. Did the store have extra costumes? Oh, sure, a number. So that some employee could have put on a Santa Claus suit and mingled. Yes, but I can't say for sure. That's the point. I got a momentary impression there were 5, but it was just momentary as they were leaving. I dashed after them, and then I thought, no, I better take a look at the jewelry department. So I did. I rushed in, and there was a Santa Claus standing there. The 5th one. I don't know. I swear to you, Griswold, I can't tell if there was a 5th one, or if there was, if the one in the jewelry department was the 5th. Was he doing anything? Dan said, not by the time I came in. I was caught so by surprise that I just stared at him blankly and said, ho, 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 just automatically, you know, and he didn't answer. That was the funniest thing of all. He didn't answer. I'd have thought that it would be impossible for him not to answer with a ho, ho, ho of his own. He just stared at me briefly and left in a hurry. I said, and you chased after him? No, said Dan, looking hangdog. I wasted time. My fault, I admit, Griswold, looking about to see if anything had been broken, disturbed. Didn't see a thing, of course, and by the time I realized I ought to be following Santa Claus, it was too late. He had gone, and eventually the others came back, and there were only 4. I tell you, Griswold, I stood there thinking I was going crazy. 4? 5? I was ashamed to ask. And then, just before they were going to call it quits for the night, in came Mamselle screeching again. The necklace was gone. It had been taken right out of its case. I couldn't tell because I hadn't memorized all the things that were there. Mamselle was in hysterics. There had been a short in the warning system so that it was possible to open the case without sirens sounding all over the place, and if she hadn't foolishly announced this, I think she thought she was going to be fired out of hand, and frankly, I thought she deserved it. But I gathered she had been there from the year 1 and was a valued employee. Then I mentioned that I thought there had been a ringer in the Santa Claus department, a 5th one. And right away, everyone denied it. There had been only 4. All the Santa Clauses claimed they had been together at all times, and there had never been a 5th. I couldn't argue very vehemently. I hadn't actually seen 5. There had only been that fugitive impression. So I mentioned the Santa Claus in the jewelry department, and that really roused hostility, because that made it look as though one of the male employees had put on a Santa Claus suit and done the job after having been alerted by Mamselle's gaffe. Naturally, every one of them started giving each other alibis. Not one of them, it would seem, could possibly have been out of sight of all the others. So there you are, Griswold. It turned out no one could do it. I said, did anyone consider that it could have been an outside job, someone sneaking in, stealing the necklace, and then leaving the store? Not a chance, said Dan. Doors were all locked, and those alarms were working. Whoever did it had to know where the Santa Claus suits were, and he had to know the warning system was out. No, it was an inside job, all right. The trouble is that I'm the one who looks bad. I had all the knowledge needed, and I was trying to muddy the waters by talking about a fifth Santa Claus and one who was inside the jewelry department. There was no one to corroborate anything I said, and the natural thought, I suppose, was that I had done it. It was clear that that was what they thought. They didn't find the necklace on you, I hope, I said. Of course not, said Dan. They haven't found it at all. Frankly, I think whoever it was who did it must know the store pretty well. He had a hiding place all picked out. But that looks bad for me, too. I know the store pretty well. I said, when you saw that Santa Claus, Dan, was there anything recognizable about him? Recognizable? Come on, Griswold. You know what a Santa Claus suit is like. Covers the entire body with padding. You wear white gloves, you got a white wig and a thick white beard. The only part of you that shows are your eyes, nose, and cheekbones. I wouldn't be able to recognize my brother if he were dressed up like that. The nose was visible. Noses are pretty distinctive. Was it a snub nose, a long nose, a crooked nose, a blunt nose? Griswold, I can't tell you. I explained I was caught entirely by surprise. That Santa Claus and I were together for only 15 seconds. The only thing in the wide world I can tell you is that he didn't ho-ho-ho me. It's just an insoluble mystery as far as I'm concerned, but not as far as anyone else is concerned. Everyone else thinks it's me. And even if they can't prove it, Griswold, the word would get out and I won't get any jobs anymore. Not that I need them, you understand, but I do value my reputation, and that's shot. Oh, I don't know, Dan, I said. It doesn't seem like a terrible mystery to me. I should think the solution is quite simple. Dan looked up at me sharply. Oh, come on. No, really, I said, and explained. His eyes opened wide, and as a matter of fact, when faced with exactly what had been done, the malefactor broke down and the necklace was recovered. What was most important was that Dan emerged without a stain on his character. In fact, he was viewed as the one who solved the mystery. And that's my Christmas story. That's your Christmas phony, Griswold, I said angrily. What solution are you talking about? How'd you get a solution out of what you told us? Griswold, who had apparently been settling down to resume his nap, snapped his eyes open again. I can't believe you can't see it. He looked at Jennings, then at Baranoff. Don't you two see it either? They shook their heads. Griswold sighed. The people I have to deal with. Look, it seems quite clear that the Santa Claus costume hides everything about a person except the eyes, nose, and cheekbones, right? Right, we chorused. Well, there's one other thing it doesn't hide, you idiots. It doesn't hide the voice. The voice? Absolutely. That's why the Santa Claus in the jewelry department didn't go, ho, ho, ho. He couldn't, because he wasn't a he. He was a woman. Mamselle was tall. She was skinny, but there was padding. Everything was covered that could be covered, but she had a high-pitched voice. She couldn't have emitted a bass, ho, 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 if you had pointed a gun at her. And the absence of it gave her away. She knew the warning system was off. She had gimmicked it herself, and she made the announcement concerning it and wore the suit to spread suspicion to the men. Griswold smiled and lifted his glass. Ho, 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 gentlemen.
Ho, 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 Merry Christmas.
You're listening to the 2017 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, Mistletoe Mysteries. I'm Pearl Hewitt. Large numbers of Scots emigrated to Virginia. after the defeat of Bonnie Prince Charlie and the Highland clearances. Many of its inhabitants still cherish Scottish traditions, but few get more fun out of them than Sharon McCrum. There's Scots blood on both sides of her family, and furthermore she has a Scots-born friend who learned about Hogmanay the hard way. Being tall and dark, he used to get thrust out of doors at 10 minutes to midnight on December 31st with a lump of coal in his pocket. As the first to set foot over the neighbours' thresholds once the new year struck, he brought them all luck for the coming year. His own luck wasn't so great, though. He'd be half frozen by the time he'd done his good deed for the year and could go home to thaw out. So it's not surprising that Sharon chose to write about Hogmanay, which is much more important to a Scot than Christmas. Let's find out who gets the luck in her story titled A Wee Doc and Doris. He stood for a long while staring up at the house, but all was quiet. There was one light on in an upstairs window, but he saw no shadows flickering on the shades. Not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Lewis smirked to himself. Christmas wasn't so hot if you were in his line of work. People tended to stay home with the family, the one night a year when everybody wishes they were the Waltons. But all that togetherness wore off in a week. By now everybody had cabin fever, and they were dying to get away from the in-laws and the rugrats. That's how it was in his family, anyway. By New Year's Eve, his ma had recovered from the thrill of receiving candy from Anthony, bubble bath from Michael, and a bottle of perfume from Lewis, and she had started nagging again. Lewis always gave her a bottle of perfume. He preferred small, lightweight gifts that could be slipped easily and unobtrusively into one's pocket. He also preferred not to have endless discussions with his nearest and dearest over whether he was going to get a job or enroll in the auto mechanics program at the community college. Neither idea appealed to Lewis. He liked his schedule, sleeping until 11, a quick burger for brunch, and a few hours of volunteer work at the animal shelter. Nobody at the shelter thought Lewis was lazy or unmotivated. He was their star helper. He didn't mind hosing down the pens and cleaning the food dishes, but what he really enjoyed was playing with the dogs and brushing down the shaggy ones. They didn't have a lot of money at the shelter, so they couldn't afford to pay him. It took all their funds to keep the animals fed and healthy. The shelter refused to put a healthy animal to sleep. Lewis heartily approved of this policy, and thus he didn't mind working for free. In fact, sometimes when the shelter's funds were low, he gave them a donation from the funds of his night's work. Lewis thought that rich people should support local charities. He saw himself as the middleman, except that his share of the take was 90%. Lewis also believed that charity begins at home. Christmas was good for the shelter. Lots of people, high on the Christmas spirit, adopted kittens and puppies or gave them as gifts, and the shelter saw to it that they got a donation for each adoptee. So their budget was doing okay, but Lewis's personal funds were running short. Christmas is not a good time of year for a burglar. Sometimes he'd find an empty house whose occupants were spending Christmas out of town, but usually the neighbourhood was packed with nosy people, eyeballing every car that went by. You'd think they were looking for Santa. If Christmas was bad for business, New Year's Eve made up for it. Lots of people went out to parties that night and did not plan on coming home until well after midnight. Being out for just the evening made them less security conscious than the Christmas people who went out of town. New Year's partygoers were less likely to hide valuables, activate alarms, or ask the police to keep an eye on the premises. Lewis had had a busy evening. He'd started around 9 o'clock, when even the tardiest guests would have left for the party, and he had hit 4 houses, passing on one because of a Doberman Pinscher in the backyard. Lewis had nothing against the breed, but he found them very unreasonable and not inclined to give strangers the benefit of the doubt. The other four houses had been satisfactory, though. The first one was guarded by a haughty white Persian whose owners had forgotten to feed it. Lewis put down some canned mackerel for the cat and charged its owners one portable television, one 35mm camera, three pairs of earrings, a CD player, and a collection of compact discs. The other houses had been equally rewarding. After a day's visit to various flea markets and pawn shops, his financial standing should be greatly improved. This was much better than auto mechanics. Lewis realised that larceny and auto mechanics are almost never mutually exclusive, but he felt that in freelance burglary, the hours were better. He glanced at his watch. A little after midnight. This would be his last job of the evening. Lewis wanted to be home before the drunks got out on the highway. His New Year's resolution was to campaign for gun control and for tougher drunk driving laws. He turned his attention back to the small white house with the boxwood hedge and the garden gnome next to the birdbath. No danger of Lewis stealing that. He thought people ought to have to pay to have garden gnomes stolen. A promising sideline. He would have to consider it. But now to the business at hand. The hedge seemed high enough to prevent the neighbours from seeing into the yard. The house across the street was vacant, with the big yellow for sale sign stuck in the yard. The brick split level next door was dark, but they had a chain-link fence, and their front yard was floodlit, like the exercise yard of a penitentiary. Lewis shook his head. Paranoia and bad taste. There was no car in the driveway, a promising sign that no one was home. He liked the look of the rectangular kitchen window. It was partly hidden by a big azalea bush, and it looked like the kind of window that opened out at the bottom, with a catch to keep it from opening too far. It was about 6 feet off the ground. Lewis was tempted to look under the garden gnome for the spare house key, but he decided to have a look at the window instead. Using a key was unsporting. Besides, the exercise would be good for him. If you are a burglar, your physique is your fortune. He walked a lot too. Tonight, Lewis had parked his old Volkswagen a couple of streets away, not so much for the exercise as for the fact that later no one would remember seeing a strange car in the vicinity. The long walk back to the car limited Lewis's take to the contents of a pillowcase or two, also from the burgled home, but he felt that most worthwhile burglary items were small and lightweight anyway. The pillowcases he gave as baby gifts to new parents of his acquaintance, explaining that they were the perfect size to use as a cover for a bassinet mattress. Even better than a fitted crib sheet, he insisted, because after the kid grows up, you can use the pillowcases yourself. Lewis was nothing, if not resourceful. He stayed close to the boxwood hedge as he edged closer to the house. With a final glance to see that no one was driving past, he darted for the azalea bush and ended up crouched behind it, just under the rectangular window. Perfect. Fortunately, it wasn't too cold tonight. Temperature in the mid-30s, about average for the Virginia Christmas season. When it got colder than that, his dexterity was impaired, making it hard to jimmy locks and tamper with windows. It was an occupational hazard. Tonight would be no problem, though, unless the window had some kind of inside lock. It didn't. He was able to chin himself on the windowsill and pull the window outward enough to get a hand inside and slip the catch. With that accomplished, another 20 seconds of wriggling got him through the window and onto the formica countertop next to the sink. There had been a plant on the windowsill, but he managed to ease that onto the counter before sliding himself all the way through. The only sound he made was a slight thump as he went from countertop to floor. No problem if the house was unoccupied. Taking out his pen-sized flashlight, Lewis checked out the kitchen. It was squeaky clean. He could even smell the lemon floor cleaner. He shone the light on the gleaming white refrigerator. Some people actually put their valuables in the freezer compartment. He always checked that last, though. In the corner next to the back door was a small washing machine and an electric dryer, with clean clothes stacked neatly on the top. Lewis eased his way across the room and inspected the laundry. Women's clothes, small sizes, towels, dishcloths. Ah, there they were. Pillowcases. He helped himself to the two linen cases, sniffing them appreciatively. Fabric softener, very nice. Now he was all set. Time to shop around. He slipped into the dining room and flashed the light on the round oak table and the ladder-back chairs. Two places laid for breakfast. Weren't they the early birds, though? The salt and pepper shakers looked silver. They were in the shape of pheasants. Lewis slid them into his pillowcase and examined the rest of the room. The glass of the china cabinet flashed his light back at him. Bunch of flowery plates. No chance that he'd be taking those. He looked around for a silver chest, but didn't see one. He'd check on it later. He wanted to examine the living room first. Lewis flashed an exploratory light at the fireplace, the chintz couch covered in throw pillows, and the glass-fronted bookcase. There were some candlesticks on the mantelpiece that looked promising. As he crept forward to inspect them, the room was flooded with light. Squinting at the sudden brightness, Lewis turned toward the stairs and saw that he wasn't alone. The overhead lights had been switched on by a sweet-faced old woman in a green velvet bathrobe. Lewis braced himself for the scream, but the old lady was smiling. She kept coming daintily down the stairs, smiling. Lewis stared, trying to think up a plausible story. She couldn't have been more than 5 feet tall, and her blue eyes sparkled from a wrinkled but pleasant face. She patted her white permed hair into place. She looked delighted. Probably senile, Lewis thought.
"Well, I'm that glad to see you," the woman said brightly. "I was afraid it was going to be my daughter, Doris."
Definitely senile, thought Lewis. "No, it's just me," he said, deciding to play along. He held the pillowcase behind his back.
"Just after midnight too, isn't it? Oh, that's grand, that is. Otherwise I'd have to ask you to go out and come in again, you know."
Lewis noticed her accent now. It was sort of English, he thought, but she wasn't making any sense. "Come in again?"
"Ah, well, being an American, you wouldn't know the custom, would you? Well, you're welcome all the same. Now what can I get for you?"
Lewis realised just in time that she meant food or drink, rather than jewellery and savings bonds.
"Nothing for me, thanks," he said, giving her a little wave and trying to edge for the front door.
Her face fell.
"Oh, no, please, you must let me fix you something. Otherwise you'll be taking the luck away with you. How about a nice piece of cake? I made it today. And a bit of strong drink. It's New Year's, after all."
She still didn't look in the least perturbed, and she wasn't trying to get to the telephone or to trip an alarm. Lewis decided that he could definitely use a drink. The old lady beamed happily up at him and motioned for him to follow her into the kitchen.
"I've been baking for 2 days," she confided. "Now let's see, what will you have?"
She rummaged around in a cupboard, bringing out an assortment of baked goods on glass plates, which she proceeded to spread out on the kitchen table. She handed Lewis a blue flowered plate and motioned for him to sit down. When she went in the dining room to get some cloth napkins, Lewis stuffed the pillowcase under his coat, making sure that the salt and pepper shakers didn't clink together. Finally, he decided that the least suspicious thing to do would be to play along. He sat.
"Now," she announced, "we have Dundee cake with dried fruit, black bun with almonds, shortbread, petticoat tails."
Lewis picked up a flat yellow cookie and nibbled at it as his hostess babbled on.
"When I was a girl in Dundee..."
"Where?"
"Dundee, Scotland. My mother used to bake an oak bannock, you know, a wee cake, for each one of us children. The bannocks had a hole in the middle, and they were nipped in around the edges for decorations. She flavoured them with carvey, caraway seed, and we ate them on New Year's morning. They used to say that if your bannock broke while it was baking, you'd be taken ill or die in the new year. Oh, so I never baked one for my daughter Doris. Oh, but they were good. Lewis blinked. You're from Scotland? She was at the stove now, putting a large open pot on the burner and stirring it with a wooden spoon. Yes, that's right, she said. We've been in this country since Doris was 5, though. My husband wanted to come over, and so we did. I've often thought of going home now that he's passed on, but Doris won't hear of it.
Doris is your daughter? Said Lewis.
He wondered if he ought to bolt before she showed up, in case she turned out to be sane. Yes, she's all grown up now. She works very hard, does Doris. Can you imagine having to work on Hogmanay?
On what?
Hogmanay, New Year's Eve. She's out right now, poor dear, finishing up her shift. That's why I was so glad to see you tonight. We could use a bit of luck this year, starting with a promotion for Doris. Try a bit of the Dundee cake. It's awfully rich, but you can stand the calories from the look of you.
Lewis reached for another pastry, still trying to grasp a thread of sense in the conversation. He wanted to know why he was so welcome. Apparently she hadn't mistaken him for anyone else, and she didn't seem to wonder what he was doing in her house in the middle of the night. He kept trying to think of a way to frame the question without incriminating himself. Steam was rising in white spirals from the pot on the stove. The old lady took a deep breath over the fumes and nodded briskly.
Right, that should be done now. Tell me, lad, are you old enough to take spirits?
After a moment's hesitation, Lewis realised that he was being offered a drink and not a séance.
I'm 22, he mumbled. Right enough, then.
She ladled the steaming liquid into two cups and set one in front of him. Lewis sniffed it and frowned.
It's called a het paint, said the old lady without waiting for him to ask. It's an old drink given to first footers. Spirits, sugar, beer and eggs. When I was a girl, they used to carry it round door to door in a kettle back in Dundee. Not that I drink much myself, of course. Oh, Doris is always on about my blood pressure. Oh, but tonight is Hogmanay. And I said to myself, Flora, why don't you stir up the het paint? You never know who might drop in. And you see I was right. Here you are.
Here I am, Lewis agreed, taking a swig of his drink.
It tasted a little like eggnog. Not bad. At least it was alcoholic. He wouldn't have more than a cup, though. He still had to drive home. The old lady, Flora, sat down beside Lewis and lifted her cup.
Well, here's to us, then. What's your name, lad?
Lewis, he said, before he thought better of it.
Well, Lewis, here's to us, and not forgetting a promotion for Doris.
They clinked their cups together and drank to the new year. Flora dabbed at the corners of her mouth with a linen napkin and reached for a piece of shortbread.
I must resolve to eat fewer of these during the coming year, she remarked. Else Doris will have me out jogging.
Lewis took another piece to keep her company. It tasted pretty good. Sort of like a sugar cookie with delusions of grandeur.
Did you have a nice Christmas? He asked politely.
Flora smiled. Perhaps not by American standards. Doris had the day off and we went to church in the morning and then had our roast beef for dinner. She gave me bath powder and I gave her a new umbrella. She's always losing umbrellas. I suppose that's a rather subdued holiday by your lights. But when I was a girl, Christmas wasn't such a big festival in Scotland. The shops didn't even close for it. We considered it a religious occasion for most folk, and a lark for the children. The holiday for grown-up people was New Year's.
Good idea, grunted Lewis. Over here we get used to high expectations when we're kids, and then as adults we get depressed every year because Christmas is just neckties and boredom.
Flora nodded.
Oh, but you should have seen Hogmanay when I was a girl. Oh, no matter what the weather, people in Dundee would gather in the city square to wait out the old year's end, and there'd be a great time of singing all the old songs. Auld Lang Syne? Asked Lewis. That's a Scottish song, of course, nodded Flora, but we sang a lot of the other old tunes as well. And there was country dancing, and then, just when the new year was minutes away, everyone would lapse into silence, waiting. There you'd be in the dark square with your breath frosting the air and the stars shining down on the world like snowflakes on velvet. Oh, and it was so quiet you could hear the ticking of the gentlemen's pocket watches.
Sounds like Times Square, said Lewis, inspecting the bottom of his cup.
Flora took the cup and ladled another het pint for each of them.
After the carrying on to welcome in the new year, everyone would go about visiting and first-footing their neighbours. My father was always in great demand for that, being tall and dark as he was, and he used to carry lumps of coal in his overcoat to be sure of his welcome.
What, said Lewis, is first-footing?
Well, it's an old superstition, said Flora thoughtfully. Quite pagan, I expect, if the truth were told. But then you can never be sure, can you? You don't have a lump of coal about you by any chance?
Lewis shook his head.
Ah, well, first footing, you asked.
She took a deep breath, as if to warn him that there was a long explanation to follow.
In Scotland, the tradition is that the first person to cross your threshold after midnight on Hogmanay symbolises your luck in the year to come. The first foot to enter your house, you see?
Lewis nodded.
It's lucky to be burgled, he was thinking.
The best luck of all comes if you're first footed by a tall, dark stranger carrying a lump of coal.
Sometimes family friends would send round a tall, dark house guest that our family had not met so that we could be first footed by a stranger. Yes, the rest of the party would catch up with him a few minutes later.
I guess I fit the bill all right, Lewis remarked.
He was just over 6 feet and looked more Italian than Tony Bennett. His uncles called him Luigi.
So you do, smiled Flora. Now the worst luck for the new year is to be first-footed by a short blonde woman who comes in empty-handed.
Lewis remembered the first thing the old woman had said to him.
So Doris is a short blonde?
She is that. Gets her height from me, or the lack of it. And she can never remember to hunt up a lump of coal or bring some wee gift home with her to help the luck. Ever since Colin passed away, Doris has been the first foot in this house, and where has it got us? Her with long hours and precious little time off, and me with rheumatism and a fixed income. Well, prices go up every year. We could use a change of luck. Maybe a sweepstakes win.
Lewis leaned back in his chair, struggling between courtesy and common sense.
You really believe in all this stuff? He asked her.
A sad smile. Where's the harm? When you get older, it's hard to let go of the customs you knew when you were young. You'll see.
Lewis couldn't think of any family customs, except eating in front of the TV set and never taking the last ice cube, so you wouldn't have to refill the tray. Other than that, he didn't think he had much in common with the people he lived with. He thought about telling Flora about his work at the animal shelter, but he decided that it would be a dangerous thing to do. She already knew his name. Any further information would enable her and the police to locate him in a matter of hours. If she ever cottoned on to the fact that he had been robbed, that is.
Do you have any pets? He asked.
Flora shook her head.
We used to have a wee dog, but he got old and died a few years back. I haven't wanted to get another one, and Doris is too busy with her work to help in taking care of one.
I could get you a nice puppy from...
He stopped himself just in time.
Well, never mind.
You're right. Dogs are more work than most people think, or they ought to be.
Flora beamed.
Oh, what a nice young man you are.
He smiled back, nervously. Lewis nibbled another piece of shortbread while he considered his dilemma. He had been caught breaking into a house,
and the evidence from the rest of the evening's burglaries was in the trunk of his Volkswagen. The logical thing to do would be to kill the old dear so that he wouldn't have to worry about getting caught. Logical, yes, but distasteful. Lewis was not a killer. The old lady reminded him of one of the sad-eyed cocker spaniels down at the shelter. Sometimes people brought in pets because they didn't want them anymore, or were moving, or because the kid was allergic to them. Often these people asked that the animal be destroyed, which annoyed Lewis no end. Did they think that if they didn't want the pet, no one else should have it? Suppose divorce worked like that. Lewis could see putting an old dog to sleep if it was feeble and suffering, but not just because the owners found it inconvenient to have it around. He supposed that his philosophy would have to apply to his hostess as well, even if she were a danger to his career. After all, Flora was old, but she was not weak or in pain. She seemed quite spry and happy, in fact, and Lewis couldn't see doing away with her just for expedience. After all, people had rights too, just like animals. He wondered what he ought to do about her. It seemed to boil down to two choices. He could tie her up, finish robbing the house, and make his getaway, or he could finish his tea and leave, just as if he had been an ordinary, what was it? First footer. He leaned back in his chair, considering the situation, and felt a sharp jab in his side. A moment's reflection told him what it had been. The tale of the pheasant salt shaker. He had stashed the pair in the pillowcase, now concealed under his coat. He couldn't think of any way to get rid of his loot without attracting suspicion. Then she might realize that he was a burglar. Then she might panic and try to call the police. Then he would have to hit her to keep himself from being captured. It was not an appealing scenario. Lewis decided that the kindest thing to do would be to tie her up, finish his job, and leave. Flora was prattling on about Scottish cakes and homemade icing, but he hadn't been listening. He thought it would be rather rude to begin threatening his hostess while he still had a mouthful of cake, but he told himself that she had been rather rude too. After all, she hadn't asked him anything about himself. That was thoughtless of her. A good hostess ought to express a polite interest in her guests. Flora's interminable story seemed to have wound down at last. She looked up at the kitchen clock. It was after 1. "Well," she said, beaming happily at Lewis, "it's getting late. Can I get you a wee Doc and Doris?" Lewis blinked. "A what?" "A drink, lad. Wee Doc and Doris is a Scottish expression for the last drink of the evening. One for the road, as you see over here. Scotch, perhaps?" He shook his head. "I'm afraid not," he said. "I do have to be going, but I'm afraid I will have to tie you up now." He braced himself for tears, or even worse, a scream. But the old lady simply took another sip of her drink and waited. She wasn't smiling anymore, but she didn't look terrified either. Lewis felt his cheeks grow hot, wishing he could just get out of there. Burglars weren't supposed to have to interact with people. It wasn't part of the job description. If you liked emotional scenes, you became an armed robber. Lewis hated confrontations. "I hope this won't change your luck for the new year or anything," he mumbled. "But the reason I came in here tonight was to rob the house. You see, I'm a burglar." Flora nodded, still watching him closely. Not a flicker of surprise had registered on her face. "I really enjoyed the cakes and all. But after all, business is business." "In Scotland, it's considered unlucky to do evil after you've accepted the hospitality of the house," the old lady said calmly. Lewis shrugged. "In America, it's unlucky to miss car payments." She made no reply to this remark, but continued to gaze up at him impassively. At least she wasn't being hysterical. He almost wished that he had given up the whole idea. Lewis cleared his throat and continued, "The reason I have to tie you up is that I have to finish getting the stuff, and I have to make sure you can't call for help until I'm long gone. But I won't beat you up or anything." "Kind of you," she said dryly.
There's some spare clothesline in the bottom drawer of the left-hand cabinet. He looked at her suspiciously. Don't try anything, okay? I don't want to have to do anything rough. He didn't carry a gun. Nobody was supposed to be home. But they both knew that a strong young man like Lewis could do considerable damage to a frail old lady like Flora with his fists, a candlestick, almost anything could be a weapon. Keeping his eyes on her, he edged toward the cabinet, squatting down to pull out the drawer. She watched him steadily, making no move to leave her seat. As he eased the drawer open, he saw the white rope clothesline neatly bundled above a stack of paper bags. With considerable relief at the ease of it all, he picked up the rope and turned back to the old lady.
Okay, he said, a little nervously. I'm going to tie you up. Just relax. I don't want to make it so tight it cuts off circulation. But I'm not, like, experienced, you know? Just sit in the chair with your feet flat on the floor in front of you.
She did as she was told, and he knelt and began winding the clothesline around her feet, anchoring it to the legs of the chair. He hoped it wasn't going to be too painful, but he couldn't risk her being able to escape. To cover his uneasiness at the silent reproach from his hostess, Lewis began to whistle nervously as he worked. That was probably why he didn't hear anything suspicious. His first inkling that anything was wrong was that Flora suddenly relaxed in her chair. He looked up quickly, thinking, "Oh, God, the old girl's had a heart attack." But her eyes were open, and she was smiling. She seemed to be gazing at something just behind him. Slowly, Lewis turned his head in the direction of the back door. There was a short, blonde woman of about 30 standing just inside the door. She was wearing a dark blue uniform and a positively menacing expression. But what bothered Lewis the most about the intruder was the fact that her knees were bent, and she was holding a service revolver in both hands, its barrel aimed precisely at Lewis's head. Lewis looked from the blonde woman to Flora and back again, just beginning to make the connection. A jerk of the gun barrel made him move slowly away from the chair and put his hands up. "This is my daughter, Doris," said Flora calmly. "She's a policewoman. You see, you were lucky for us, Lewis. I'm sure she'll get her promotion after this."
We hope you enjoyed the 2017 Sight into Sound Christmas special, Mistletoe Mysteries. These two stories were selected from a book titled Tales of Yuletide Murder, Mistletoe Mysteries, a cosy collection of criminality at Christmas time by Charlotte MacLeod. Thank you to Jim Abate for joining me in reading these stories. The 2017 Sight into Sound Christmas special is a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas. Your producer was Jim Martinez. I'm Pearl Hewitt.